Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome to Amazing Avenue in Conversation. My name is Brian Salvatore. Today, my co-host Chris McShane and I are joined by Mets PR legend Jay Horowitz. In addition to working for the Mets for 40 years, Jay just authored a new book called Mr. Met, How a Sports Mad Kid from Jersey Became Like Family to Generations of Big Leaguers. The book tells stories from all the players you hope you hear about. It talks about some really important people in his life. It talks about the joy of working for the Mets and so much more. So we got a chance to talk with Jay a few weeks ago about the book, and I think what comes across in this conversation is just how much Jay really felt like the Mets were and are his family, and that's a really rare thing to find in baseball or anywhere else. And so enjoy Chris and I chatting with Jay Horowitz. We are joined on the line tonight by Jay Horowitz. He is a longtime legend of PR in the sports field. He has a new book out called Mr. Met. It talks about his 40 years working for the New York Mets. Jay, thank you so much for making the time for us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Of course. So both Chris and I had a chance to read the book. And one of the things that I was struck with in the book is just the consistency of a baseball team is almost non-existent. You know, players come and go, managers come and go, sometimes owners come and go. But you were a part of the Mets for a very, very long time. And I wonder, as you're looking back on your, 40 years with the team, when you think back to the golden age, what was that for you? What period was the golden age for you?
Well, probably the best period we've had with the Mets, it was 84 to 90. We probably averaged about 93, 94 wins a year. We won 108 games in the championship in 86, 100 games in 88. And, that was probably, we were like, if they had the wild card back then, we would have been in the playoffs every year, and unfortunately, in 88 when Soshi hits a home run against Doc, it kind of, we should have won the Dodgers series. They had beaten 7-11 times that year, but that's probably that in my 40 years here, that's probably the most consistent run we've ever had.
But in terms of working for the team, was that also the most fun time working as a part of the Mets?
This may sound like being a PR guy, but I never really tried to let how the record was affect how I did the job. I try to be professional every day. I had a couple of main philosophies. Treat every player on the team like he was the number one player. I try to treat the 25th guy like he was the number one guy. I couldn't lie, especially in this market. If you're working in, say, Kansas City or Seattle, there's maybe one or two papers. In New York, there's 25, 30, 40 people there. In a game, and if once you lose your credibility, you're a dead person. So I try to be honest, maybe not tell everything I knew, but not lie, because if you get caught in one lie, you're, as a PR guy, you're a dead person, and try and treat every player like he was the number one guy on the team. Those are my two guiding principles that I went through in all my years with the Mets.
Going back to some of that, reading about the people that you have worked with that you wrote up in the book, and being familiar with the sort of the cast of characters, especially over the last decade or so, Brian and I were both young. I was too young to remember the 86 team, to have any memory of it.
Right.
I don't, Brian and I are close in age, but, going back, were there any characters that stood out, like in our time of being fully conscious adults who are tuned into the Mets, every day? We know R.A. Dickey, was well read and like talking about that. We know certain characters come through who aren't necessarily, the superstars, the David Wrights, the Mike Piazzas. Were there any characters from, back when we were a little bit younger that maybe they even got covered, but that we just didn't know about?
Well, I'll go way back. In 1980, my first year here, we had a guy named Dyer Miller, who was a relief pitcher. And his claim to fame was, back then, we did cow milking contests in Chicago, St. Louis, and Cincinnati. Dyer Miller was undefeated in cow milking contests. He was a relief pitcher. He was a long time, then he became a coach with the Cardinals. Doug Flynn in the early years, he signed a really the first second long-term contract for a Mets player, 5 years, but his claim to fame was he sang with the Oak Ridge Boys and the Loretta Lynn Band. But on the night he signed his contract, I had a great idea. We had it at a country and western place out of Manhattan, and Frank Cash, who was the GM at the time, I convinced him to wear a cowboy hat during the press conference. Unfortunately for me, when he took the picture, the hat slid down over his face, and the next day in the Daily News and the Post, he looked like Elmer Fudd with the cowboy hat slid down. It wasn't a very good picture, but probably the most the top character I've worked with in my years with the Mets, a little bit later, is, you know, Johnny Franco, who we got from the Reds in the 90s. You know, he had a great career, 14 years, and I could have written a whole book and all the practical jokes that Johnny played on me. Probably the best joke ever was we're in a hotel, in the Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles, and Johnny had the great idea. He unscrewed a horse head from the lobby, went up to my room, got my keys to my room, shut the lights in my room, put the horse head under my pillows, got ketchup, put it on bed sheet, and when I walked into my room, I thought I was having a heart attack. But Johnny would do things. He would, you know, put rats in my work bag, put ice cream in my suit pockets, put whiteout on my glasses when I travel. But, and, you know, Johnny told me one thing. He said, Jay, I don't know one thing. If the players don't like you, they won't screw with you. And so I guess through the years, the guys liked me because in all my 40 years, they screwed me a lot. And I always took it the right way that, you know, in the locker room, it was kind of a different mentality, guys. If you let stuff affect you, you know, that kind of stuff, and you won't have any impact in the locker room. I roll with the punches. I was always okay with having a joke playing on me, and I knew it was meant from love.
The U.S. election doesn't happen until November, but on the island of Explained, their election is happening right now.
The later party is always saying, you get things later, but I say, let's get them now!
You know what happens when you get everything now? You don't end up with anything later!
Join us for important debates.
I think that now is moving a little too fast.
Slightly less important debates.
I happen to be 2 inches tall.
That's a lie.
And debates that are going on in the U.S. too. Like what to do about the Electoral College.
This is corrupted.
I think you should count everyone the same.
We should change it.
Come back with us to the Island of Explained, wherever you find the Today Explained podcast.
Now, you know, you mentioned being in the clubhouse, and I'm sure that the culture around baseball has changed considerably, you know, in your time working for the Mets. What is the biggest change sort of in ballpark culture, in culture among the players, since you started working with the Mets?
It's Twitter, no question. I mean, when I first started, somebody was injured. And now, my last couple of years as a PR guy, hardly on any releases. Agents did it over the play, did it, or it leaked out, or it just... And the thing itself is to have the to be with and let the players know, be aware who you're with, who going up an elevator. Remember the thing when Michael Phelps almost ruined his career? I guess somebody put on Twitter he was smoking pot in a party or something like that. Just the players have to be aware more of what's going on. You eventually get away from the cell phone or tweet, or, you know, be careful with the tweet. You know, I mean, stuff in the papers of guys losing their jobs. Just with the players today have to be much more alert. There's much more media, much more, you know, the locker room. There's a lot of, you know, mainstream media is more part of it. Wasn't anything like this, you know. It was all, you know, certain papers, but now it's branched off in a lot of different areas. The players have to be much more alert. The play as well when I first started.
Sort of in a similar spirit there. You know, I know you write in the book, you mentioned joining Twitter yourself. The day-to-day of dealing...
Grudgingly.
but yeah, that sort of day-to-day, obviously, you know, you're keeping an eye on the, you know, what the players are doing, and that's your top priority. But, you know, over the decades that you worked with the team, how did your consumption of the stories, change over the decades? I know in any other industry, you might go from, collecting clips from newspapers and distributing them and all that. You know, obviously we're in a very different time now. But what was your observation of the change of sports media in New York City as, things shifted from print only to a hybrid, and we're still in that hybrid mode, but, even the traditional papers, obviously most people are reading them on a computer, a tablet, a phone,
You had much more things. I mean, before, when a locker room opened, I would be two, what I would give with a guy like John Heyman or Ken Rosenthal or Buster Olney or Joel Sherman wrote, to make the manager aware, to make the GM aware before, I didn't expect the manager or Terry Collins or my last years or Bobby Valentine, we ran up looking at Twitter all the time. So before we had the press conference, we used to make them aware of, what the kind of leading guys in the business are saying, so they're not cut short. Like if there's a rumor out there, just to make the GM or the manager aware what's out there, so they're not caught short. I was so proud. I didn't want my side when they held the press conference for a manager briefing, they were not aware of it. So the front of that, that it was my job to make them aware, so at least they would know what to say or be aware of what was out there. So just many, many more things to monitor.
Yeah, is there, thinking back to some stories that you hear as a baseball fan over the years, I know on the Camden Yards tour, they love telling a story where Ken Rosenthal, since you mentioned his name, he was a beat reporter covering the Orioles at the time. I forget who the player was, but he had written something about a player, and then shortly thereafter, a foul ball comes back off that player's bat and, smashes Ken Rosenthal's laptop. Are there any funny stories that stand out from the press box of, a writer that every Mets fan knows that, had something along those lines?
What happened to me is that my eyesight is not good. I think if you read the book, I made aware that, I was born blind in my right eye, and I got an artificial eye when I was 12 or 13. That was one of the reasons why I wrote the book, to kind of be an inspiration to kids who are born with a disability, that you can make some of yourself. So I used to like to watch the games through binoculars, because it would help me see the bullpen and in the game. So more than once, I got a foul ball right my binoculars, it cracked my binoculars. I didn't see the ball coming, and I'd be watching the games. Nobody gave me a heads up. The ball would, I never was hurt seriously, but more than once or twice, the ball came up, hit my binoculars, and I didn't have my binoculars. I don't think I'd be here talking to you guys tonight, but a lot of times, I remember when guy Kevin Kiernan used to write for the Post, once it went away, get something to eat, a foul ball came, and and would crack the computer. But it really takes a lot to get in. There wasn't a whole lot of when I can remember, but I got hit more than once in my binoculars, I can tell you that.
Now, one of the things that I was curious about in reading the book was, you talk a lot about the good relationships that you had with certain players and how you saw yourself as a protector of them, as a gatekeeper for them. Was there a player that you started off with a rocky relationship with that by the end of their tenure, you guys were particularly close?
Well, I pride myself, guys. I never really had an adversarial relationship with anybody, even, here, I don't know if you guys are too young to remember, Dave Kingman, kind of back in the early 1980s, he actually lived at my house for a couple of weeks. I mean, I took it to myself when we got a guy in the trade to introduce myself as a big trade and offer, when do kids want to go to school? So, I mean, 86, I was 39, 40, with Mookie and Lima Dilley and, you know, and Sid and Bobby Ojeda. You know, they're still my closest friends. You know, of course, the, you know, of course, the age difference, and I still, you know, of course, Daryl and Doc, I think, you know, God, they helped me out with interviews and stuff like that. But, you know, then going into the 2000s, you know, when David Wright came up, and, you know, David was one guy, as good of a player as he was 100 times better person, you know, and I grew with, I kind of didn't really have, you know, one guy that grew with. I kind of tried to make everybody feel comfortable, like, you know, Lance Wilson was a catcher, he did a lot of charity stuff, he wasn't the number one guy. Players are not stupid, guys. And if they see him in the locker room catering to the all-star guys, it kind of is a bad vibe. And I, that's one of the things I pride myself on, to be available to the Trouble Cueys, to the Vance Wilsons, you know, of the world, to the, you know, to Kim Perez, things like trying to treat everybody equal.
Now, I have to ask this question as a fellow Passaic County resident. I'm up in Ringwood, in Passaic
right.
County, and you know, you've lived your whole life, you know, or most of your life in Clifton, New Jersey, and you're you're coming over the bridge every day. And was there ever a time where you just felt the call of the city, but for whatever reason decided to stay in Jersey? You know, what is it about Clifton that has kept you here all these years?
I've had animals my whole life, you know what I mean? And people here, probably took care of the animals. I just like to think of getting away, you know, having some quiet. You know, Clifton's not a big town, you know, the grass and stuff like that. And I just, you know, I'm a big football Giants fan, so I'm close to the Giants. I'm not a great guy. I just get up 5 o'clock in the morning, be at my desk at 6:30, do an email. And we stay for the game, we leave 12:30, get on the 1 o'clock, and you start your routine all over again. It weren't great. So, but it was, I just like to get away, you know. I mean, not that I don't, I just like the being there, and it's great to the park where I live. I just got comfortable here living here. I never really wanted to move.
As a lifelong Jersey resident, I get it. I do.
Yeah.
I have not lived in Jersey, but I know in the book you write about somebody who obviously was very special to you and the organization, Shannon Ford, who I had the pleasure of getting to know just a little bit, you know, nowhere near as well as you knew her over the course of the time that you had worked together.
One of the reasons I wanted to write the book was not to let people forget about Shannon. He passed away from breast cancer in the spring of 2016. And when after she died, there were, you know, 9 major league teams held a moment of silence with her, for her. We held that. We had a memorial service at Citi Field. You know, David Wright spoke. There's over 1,000 people were there. And with Major League Baseball, they helped build a park in her name in her hometown of Little Ferry, Shannon Dorton Ford Field, you know, high schools and colleges play on the field. So I just wanted people, you know, she had so much courage. She fought her way to the World Series in 2015. The cancer really spread all over her body, but she wanted to work there. And it was nice at the end, you know, Jeff Wilpon presented her husband with a ring after she passed away. So she was really, like, she was like the daughter I never had, guys. And I just didn't want people to forget about her. That's why I have a nice chapter on her in the book.
Yeah, no, and, you know, like I said, it was that limited interaction, you know, for me relative to you. But in dealing with her, you know, in the first couple of times I went down to Port St. Lucie, and at some of the nights that she put together for our site and other sites like ours,
Citi Field. She got the fact that it was getting to be a different kind of media. And honestly, she would push me to make sure you take care of the guy. You know, I mean, she was the one who was really more tuned to the you know, different sites than I was in the beginning. And she said, Jay, this is the coming future. You got to take care of these people. And I don't know if you did, but she organized some meetings with the GM and players on separate nights, if I remember correctly. And she was the, you know, driving force behind that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, and the access that we had that, you know, during the time working with her,
he got it.
She was great. And everything that everybody has always said, you know, that she treated you the same, whether you were David Wright or Mike Piazza or me.
Right.
It's really, you know, legitimate. You know, it's not, people aren't just making that up. So I thought it was very fitting to write that final chapter of the book about her, because she really was, you know, an invaluable part of the team.
Yes, she was. She'll always be in my heart, guys. I can tell you that.
Thanks for listening to Amazing Avenue in Conversation. We always appreciate it. You can follow Jay Horowitz on Twitter at @J_HorowitzPR. You can follow Chris at Chris McShane. You can follow me at Brian Needs an App. You can follow Amazing Avenue at Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Go to AmazingAvenue.com for all your Mets needs. And remember, let's go Mets.